Good morning or good afternoon, everyone, depending on where you are in the world. And as Julie pointed out, happy International Year of the Soils. The UN highlighted this topic for two reasons. One is, of course, the importance of soil in our lives, but also the fragile nature of soils around the world and the challenges that farmers face in producing enough food for all of us. So it's appropriate that we bring in two of the great experts on the topic who have many years of experience working with smallholder farmers around the world. Now, land degradation or soil degradation is an incredibly big challenge, particularly now as we're expanding our global human population. A recent International Food Policy Research Institute book shows that global land degradation is now costing hundreds of billions of dollars. That includes lost productivity, less efficient use of the inputs that farmers purchase to grow their crops. And so right at the time that populations in these especially vulnerable regions, such as sub-Saharan Africa, are needing to increase productivity to feed a growing population, these farmers also have to raise their yields significantly, their crop yields. And of course, they're doing this on some of the most depleted, nutrient-depleted, some of the thinnest soils that farmers have worked with in human history. Now, on the bright side, the investments made to improving soil health, restoring soil fertility, the returns on those investments are quite large. Recent studies have found that $1 investment in soil rehabilitation returns $5 in returns to greater productivity, more efficient use of inputs, and so on. So there are many bright spots out there in terms of reversing some of the damage done, improving the soil conditions, and of course improving the livelihoods of the farmers that feed the rest of us. To highlight some of the bright spots and also some of the challenges that are faced around the world, we have two great scientists, soil scientists, that have worked for decades in some of these more vulnerable regions of the world. First, I'd like to introduce Dr. Jeff Heinrich. He's a senior technical advisor for Catholic Relief Services. He's worked for over 25 years directly with farmers in both Africa and Asia, so has a great understanding, a deep understanding of the issues faced by farmers, what drives their decision-making within their households, and how soil degradation directly affects them. Jeff has a PhD in crop and soil science, and he's worked with a range of institutions on this issue. Then, after Jeff speaks on the topic, we'll have Dr. Seglinda Snapp from Michigan State University speaking on her specific work in Africa. Sig has won many awards. Most recently, the American Society of Agronomy recognized her as a fellow for her contributions both in the United States and internationally. She's had many journal articles, extension bulletins. She specializes really in participatory action research and has really pioneered some of the research designs and how best to work with farmers, including the mother and baby trial design for which she's possibly best known. I should say she's a soils and cropping systems ecologist at Michigan State University and the associate director of the Center for Global Change and Earth Observations. Sig really works with many, many different partners, so she has firsthand direct interactions with farmers, but also many of the development agencies and research institutions that do this work. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Jeff, who is speaking to us from Malawi.
Thanks very much, Jerry. That was a really nice introduction on the soils issues. Thank you for that. And good morning or good afternoon, everyone, as Jerry noted, depending on where you are in the world. I'm going to talk today about restoring soil health for smallholder resilience in Africa and looking at critical issues and options. And Jerry has started this conversation well, but I'd also like to add my own with some quotes and photos just to outline the magnitude of that problem. So the first one is this quote from the Dust Bowl days in the U.S., that humankind, despite its artistic pretensions, its sophistication, and many accomplishments, owes its existence to a 6-inch layer of topsoil and the fact that it rains. And that might be a slight oversimplification, but essentially it's true. We really depend so much on the soil. This picture is from central Malawi, and this land has been prepared for planting. It doesn't take a lot of imagination to predict what's going to happen when you get the first heavy rain. In fact, the end result can be sort of seen up near the crest of the hill where it's basically turning to stone. Here's another quote in the photo. The rainfall runoff takes about 40% of the nutrients applied to the soil in Africa through organic and mineral resources. This is part of the losses that Jerry referred to. And you can imagine from this picture how it might be true. This picture was taken by a person named Peter Ugard, but this phenomenon is common in traditional systems, and you can see the massive loss of water, of soil, of seeds, and any fertilizer and manure that's been applied in the field. And so, I mean, the question is, how long can this be sustained without major impacts on yield and food security? It's obviously having important impacts even from this current season. So, here's a quote from FAO. In Africa, the most conspicuous symptoms of the negative impacts on land degradation on food production are stagnating and declining yields and increasing levels of poverty. Actually, this picture is cheating slightly because it's from Bolivia. But it illustrates the point that the impacts of land degradation are devastating. And if you notice down in the bottom of the hill along that pathway, there are two homesteads. And one can imagine that life for them is difficult and somewhat precarious. If you would notice also the big gullies on the hillside, we're going to come back and talk a little bit about those later. But I guess the point here is that it's very difficult to increase household food security and incomes in rural areas unless we really take care of the soil resource. Okay, one final slide with quotes and some statistics. In Africa, so land degradation has already gone very far. And in terms of land that's already damaged, it's over two-thirds of the arable land, 30% of grazing land, and 20% of forests. Another observation is that Africa is already food short, and it imports $40 billion worth of food annually. Soil is the cornerstone of food security, and its conservation should become a major global priority. And there certainly is a crisis of land degradation and soil management. So these final quotes are actually from the Montpellier panel in 2014. It was composed of some pretty eminent persons. But the takeaway really from these pictures and from these quotes is okay, so food is already in short supply in Africa if it's importing $40 billion annually. Yields are stagnant or declining. The population is doubling every 20 years. So the potential for a major food crisis is very high, going well beyond the food price crisis that we saw in 2008, which, if I remember correctly, there were riots in over 10 capital cities across the continent. So the key to avoiding disaster in the medium term really is restoring the soil and increasing the productivity and incomes of rural households and communities. And actually restoring the soil and regenerating its productive capacity has to be done before other technologies like improved seed and fertilizer can really be effective. And there's some evidence that shows that fertilizer efficiency in Africa is very directly related to the soil organic matter, which is very low and generally declining. So that's a bunch of bad news. So we'll switch over to some good news. The good news is that we can reverse soil degradation processes and restore productivity with known technology. We don't need any new information, and we can do it quite quickly in a relatively short time span if we just focus our resources and energy on that. To do it, we need to work at both the landscape level and the farm level, and I'm going to talk about those separately. And we'll start with the landscape level. And management at the landscape level is really vital because a number of important ecosystem services can only really be managed effectively at that level. And water is probably the best example. So the photo here is from a Food for Peace project in southern Malawi. And if you remember those big gullies that were on that we saw on the hillside, so there were some of these gullies here. And as part of the overall watershed restoration process, check dams were built in those gullies, and you can see those people are standing on one of the check dams. But within 2 years, the soil filled in behind the check dams, and people were able to cultivate there again. At the end of the project, we went back. There were 32 different watersheds that were rehabilitated. At the end of the project, we went back and talked to communities in a number of those watersheds, and they reported very consistently increases in stream flows, sometimes quite dramatic, rising water tables in their wells, and people also reported that they, with the watershed management, they started getting better yields even in dry years than they used to get when there were good rains. And if you can imagine all of the water that was pouring off the hillside in that second slide, you can understand why. If you capture that and it goes into the soil, that really gives you much higher potential. So the watershed management work really stabilized the soil, but it also did great things for the water resource. So looking at some of the options for landscape level management, there are a lot of them. I've just put a couple here. I put their community-based natural resource management right at the top because actually communities need to be engaged if we're going to have effective landscape level management. The communities are the custodians of their areas, and without their support, effective interventions are not really possible. But once the communities are engaged, then there are a lot of things that can be done. CRS has done a lot of good work, I think very effective work on watershed management, mostly through Food for Peace projects, actually, which is one of the few kinds of projects in which this work can be effectively done. But we've also done quite a bit in Latin America with support from the Howard Buffett Foundation. The farmer-managed natural regeneration is also really another very good intervention. I saw Doug Brown was on the line. World Vision had a lot to do with the development of that. But it's been used effectively in West Africa to regreen over 5 million hectares and really stop desertification. It's a really low-cost, effective technology. It doesn't maybe have an immediate massive effect on crop yields, but it certainly is very good at protecting the landscape. And then the issues of don't burn and don't deforest are basic tenets, but they're so common and so devastating across Africa that I think they really need to be emphasized. Okay. There's lots of things that can be done. I've only touched on a few for the landscape level stuff, but in the interest of time, I'm going to move to farm level approaches for soil regeneration. But before we look at specific technical approaches, there are two things I think we really need to consider very carefully. First is that farmers have very serious constraints in terms of adopting new technology, and if we want technologies to be adopted quickly and at scale, we really have to take these things into consideration. And there are a lot of technologies that have failed, not because they were bad technologies, but because they didn't meet some of these criteria. The four key ones are the technology needs to not cost any extra money or labor, at least very little. The second thing is it has not to have big opportunity costs. And there I just note, for example, if you want farmers to start doing rotations, It means they have to not plant maize on part of their field in any given year. And for example, eastern Zambia, 65% of farmers are net maize buyers. They don't produce enough already to feed their household, so convincing them not to plant on some of their land is quite difficult. Anyway, so the issue of opportunity cost is there. There has to be immediate benefits. It doesn't help to say, okay, do this, and then 5 years from now, everything will be fine, because farmers have also to live in the short term. So it really needs to have both short and long-term benefits. And last but not least, it needs to be feasible and accessible, which means really easy to apply. They need not to have to go to the capital city to get some sort of input. It needs to be available and easy to apply in their local area. Okay, so the farmers have those technology adoption constraints. And then the second thing is that at the macro level, the right policies and incentives need to be in place to promote regenerative forms of agriculture. And in that regard, so a lot of governments are still promoting sort of sole maize and commercial fertilizer, which are not bad in and of themselves, but they don't solve the soil problem. Some governments are also promoting conservation agriculture, which again is a good thing, but it has three main components, which are minimum soil disturbance, maximum soil cover, and rotations. So quite often they can't do the rotations, and because of other things they don't get as much mulch on the soil as they need, and so the impacts are relatively low, and we are seeing fairly slow adoption. So conservation agriculture by itself is good, but it's not really enough. So what I'm trying to say here is, so we need practical technical options that farmers can easily and profitably adopt, and we need to have the right policies and incentives in place. Okay, so then what can we do? So really at the farm level, rebuilding the soil organic matter is the key issue. We need to rebuild the organic matter for a number of reasons. First is, it increases the water holding capacity of the soil. So if you imagine a cement slab and you pour water on the cement slab, what happens? It all just runs away, right? But if you imagine now laying a big thick sponge layer over the cement and then pouring water on it, what happens? The water stays there, right? So that's what organic matter does for the soil, essentially. And the other thing it does is increase the nutrients in the soil, as well as increase nutrient availability to plants. And because of that, then it can really be effective in increasing the fertilizer use efficiency. So overall, the soil organic matter is really crucial to improving soil health and improving the fundamental productivity of the soil. Right, and the best thing that I have seen so far, the best option really, is green manure cover crops. So green manure cover crops are different from traditional rotations or from what we think of as traditional green manure processes. And I won't go into detail. What you really should do is get Roland Bunch on here for an hour and just talk about that. He really explained it very well. But I will say a few things about it in a minute, but I would just note that it's a really good option. It's often accompanied by minimum tillage. CRS is working with Roland Bunch on these options, has been for the last couple of years. Sorry, I think I've got ahead of myself. Right, I did. Okay, so I do want to say something about this picture, though. So this is not Roland Bunch in this picture, but it is a green manure cover crop system. So this picture was taken this past year in Zambia. This is a maize and velvet bean intercrop. It has had no commercial fertilizer for the last 6 years. It has had some cattle manure, but that's all. So, and they were expecting a 6-ton maize yield in this year, which is pretty good. As I mentioned, the green manure cover crops are different from traditional rotations in green manures. Mainly, what they are cereal and legume intercropping systems, or cereal tree crop intercropping systems that improve soil fertility and reduce weeds. And the legume also often has a food or income benefit. And I think they're the best option because they usually don't require any extra costs or labor or external inputs, and they often produce additional food income from the legume crop as a benefit. The last point to consider is when you use them to increase soil organic matter, they can sequester large amounts of carbon. Okay, so this picture also shows the potential of a green manure cover crop system. These pictures are from this past rainy season in the Luangwa Valley in Zambia, and they're from a project that was being run by an organization called Komako. So the picture on the left is what most of the maize fields in the area look like. This is sole maize with or without small amounts of commercial fertilizer. They were undergoing quite severe moisture stress, and the yield expectations were also quite low. The picture on the right, which is actually only a couple hundred meters from, shows a field of a smallholder farmer that's been using maize intercropped with Gliricidia for the last 6 years. And again, they don't use commercial fertilizer. They were just using some small amount of cattle manure. You can see one of the stumps of the Gliricidia trees in the foreground. So in this system, the Gliricidia branches are cut, pruned from the tree stalk before planting, and they're laid on the ground as a mulch. And that increases rainfall infiltration, it prevents evaporation and soil erosion, it reduces weed growth, and it adds a lot of organic matter and nitrogen to the soil. So there were quite a number of plots where farmers were using the Gliricidia in that area, and they were basically unaffected by below normal rainfall season. And I mean, the difference is quite stark, and I think it has important implications for food security and resilience. This is a big issue. I just want to touch on it briefly. So increasing soil organic matter and nitrogen availability usually requires intercropping with legumes or tree species or legume rotations. So to date, the commercial seed sector has shown very little interest in food legumes or tree species. So it can be a really big problem to get seeds. And I mean, CRS faces this every year in southern Africa because, like, this year we have major seed relief programs in Malawi and in Madagascar. We've had them recently in Zimbabwe and Zambia. It's very difficult to find commercial supplies of food legumes, even sometimes groundnuts. And we also, for our green manure cover crops, we are promoting in all of those countries. We want to do on-farm demonstrations. We sometimes struggle to get even enough seed to do the demonstrations, which is pretty bad. So we're going to need new systems for seeds if we want to go to scale. Right, so some of the systems that we might consider include working with the smaller seed companies on niche markets, working with farmer-based systems, or even working with the informal sector, like with this woman in this market in southern Malawi in this picture here, who is clearly very well organized. Anyway, the seed issue is a big issue. I don't want to, you can't really explain it in one slide, but I wanted to flag it and just to note that my colleague, Louise Perling, is working with, she's one of the world's leading experts on that. She's working with a number of people to start some initiatives to really try and address that, but it's going to be a critical issue as we try to go to scale in rehabilitating and rebuilding soil organic matter. Okay, so just to wrap up, I would note that it is really crucial to invest in restoring the soil, both at the farm level and at the landscape level. At the farm level in particular, the soil organic matter is crucial. But if we can improve soil health, we will improve everything else. This needs to be a priority for governments, for donors, and for the private sector, as well as farmers. And to encourage adoption at scale, we need the right policies and incentives, and we are going to have to address the seed issue. I have not said much about the private sector in this presentation, but I would just note that they have a really important role to play, both in increasing the soil productivity and in the seeds issue. If we have time at the end, we can maybe discuss that a bit more. But the good news from all of this is that there is a lot that can be done, that the impacts can be achieved quite rapidly. But as we do that, we need to remember that new technologies must address and fit within farmers' real needs and constraints. And in that regard, I'd like to remember the phrase or the saying that it's only bad technology that requires really good extension systems. So anyway, so thank you very much. I'll leave it there for now. Thank you for your attention, and I'll turn it over to my colleague and friend, Linda Snap.
So today I'll be talking about work that comes out of that work from the early 90s and is built on many connections, which I will get back to. But I just want to acknowledge right up front that my co-authors here, supported by IATA Africa Rising, which is a project of USAID. And we couldn't do it without this interdisciplinary team of ag economists, soil scientists, budding the next generation of agronomists, and our support from IATA. So we've been hearing a bit about how degraded soil seem to be a driver of food insecurity and environmental insecurity. And in fact, they go both directions. Food poverty has been seen recently to be correlated in some areas with degraded soil. So I think we're all here to try and figure out how to break those links and support increases in soil rehabilitation to support food security, ultimately. Now, we hear a lot about degraded soils from conversion of marginal lands that shouldn't be in agriculture, but I want to talk more about the other problem, which is continuous production without enough investment. So this is a way that soils are degraded, as shown here in Zimbabwe. And imagine you're in your shoes of these farmers and extension officers trying to see how we can turn this around. But one of the underlying factors, I think, is this short, very only 4 months of the year that a crop is grown. So maize is growing for maybe 4 months, and then we have this long dry season. Again, this is from Malawi, showing lands ready for planting, but if you can imagine how vulnerable this soil is to water and wind erosion. Now, we've seen recent evidence from my student, Placido Mpeketula, who just became a PhD yesterday. He'll be going back to teach University of Malawi. And very exciting but disturbing news. In the Food and Agriculture Organization went around different parts of Malawi and dug pits, and most of the soil maps that we use today come from that effort in the late 80s, early 90s, around Africa to document soil. We went back to these locations. So over this 25 years, we found that in areas where there's continuous production, in the redder areas, this is where there's also, we're seeing reduction in soil carbon. Not just where forests have been converted to agriculture, which certainly there's a loss in organic matter then, but just continuous production is leading to small but significant declines. So we seem to be not at a new plateau, but at a continuous decline in soil carbon, at least in Malawi, and that is quite worrying. So many of us here in this virtual room, we're all in this project together, and we've heard about some of the options, community level, but when we talk just about farmer decision making at household plot level, in terms of legumes to address both nitrogen and organic matter at once, and also human health, because legumes provide protein-rich beans. Farmers, we give them options, like in the mid-90s, working with Bunda College of Agriculture, and with Rockefeller Support, and Chitezi Ministry of Agriculture. We were able to try out a whole bunch of annual legumes, and we continue to work on improved varieties of beans, peanuts, so-called groundnuts, soybeans, cowpea. But in order to really improve soil fertility, these don't do that because the nutrients all go into, we eat them or we sell them, right? Perennials, such as agroforestry, we heard about this. This is Trifosia, which is fairly easy to establish for an agroforestry system just from seed. You can see it's green leaves between the maize, supporting very productive maize. But, and certainly this works, and I'm big promoter of green manures, as we heard about, and agroforestry. However, decades of work later, action research around these best-bet options for legumes, we found that, in fact, rarely could the poorest farmers adopt these. Probably the opportunity costs, even though we try and develop technologies that and build on farmers' technologies that are, you know, really low cost, but still, we just don't see a lot of traction. And so more and more, we've focused on a middle way, a type of legume, a shrub like pigeon pea, which is eaten, but is also produced, particularly when it's ratooned and grown for 2 years, can produce massive amounts of fuel wood, as you'll see, and also soil fertility regeneration. Climbing bean is another one of these, kind of in a sweet spot in between, something that grows for at least a year. Lacuna in, or velvet bean, also called velvet bean, is eaten in some places, but most places is just used as a forage. So we really see shrubby pigeon pea and climbing bean in colder areas where that can be grown as kind of this unique middle way of long duration legume in these pulse systems. So if you want to see how this works, we try to test for different soil types, different climate conditions, which requires models. Here's the APSIM model, which is one of the few crop models that are calibrated for southern eastern Africa and that allow you to look at intercrops. And you'll see on the top right here that the three systems that have pigeon pea in them are the only ones where you see an increase in soil nitrogen over time. So that's modeling data, and it's encouraging, but what do we see in the field? Well, we see farmers adopting varieties such as Mekwam Jamni, type of pigeon pea, that have these multiple benefits. Pigeon pea that gives you grain, but also bring fuel wood. This is from Malawi, where farmers, this new variety is spreading like wildfire, I can say that, and it is providing increased food security, as well as environmental security, and that they can grow their own fuel wood. So it's quite encouraging, but we wanted to see if it could fit into new places in Malawi, beyond southern Malawi, where there's markets currently. And also, what are the impacts on soil fertility? Could it be a three-way pulse? Well, pigeon pea, another way it recommends itself to farmers is that it can be grown as an intercrop, and particularly the traditional varieties and some of the farmer-selected varieties, like Mekwam Jamni, that I just mentioned, are good intercrops. In fact, that's how they're grown. You can plant them right at the same time as maize. They're very small initially, but so they don't interfere with the maize crop. And so you can get two crops for the same amount of labor. And in fact, they can suppress weeds, which is another encouraging fact and aspect of them. However, one of the challenges is this doesn't rest the soil from continuous maize production. Maize, we have found, doesn't actually increase soil fertility, even soil organic matter, despite all the residues, unless we can somehow break all that maize. And it's very difficult for, you can imagine, if you only have an acre of land, how can you dedicate part of it to soil rehabilitation that doesn't give you food? So this is a system that is the sweet spot that I think is really encouraging, because it gives us two legumes, so two crops. Here's groundnut is shown, that also you can grow soybean or common bean. Cowpea is a bit more challenging, it's very competitive. You can grow these in an understory in pigeon pea. You can see pigeon pea here is, you can see how thick the stems get even in just 1 year. And we can cut them off and ratoon them and then get a second year growth. And then in the third year we have like a pure maize crop in some cases, or sometimes maize bean. So farmers are experimenting in different options with this, but we, through support from Africa Rising, are looking at different ways that rare pigeon pea can be deployed, because you wouldn't want to disseminate it in areas where it took up too much water for all these benefits. We have to look carefully at risks, particularly in the changing climate, and with the variable climate that we know is southern Africa faces and much of Africa. So we found that although pigeon pea is grown here in the south, sometimes there's markets. In fact, an optimal area is in the middle, and so we need to see where it can be tried out, and new varieties can provide these new options for farmers that provide immediate returns as well as the long-term soil rehabilitation. Up here in Mzuzu in the north, actually is an area where now over 100 villages and tens of thousands of farmers have adopted this doubled up legume of pigeon pea, and there's actually been changes in child health, which is very exciting and needs to be more carefully studied, because it shows how this can have transformative effects when you address these underlying issues. So let's talk about Central Malawi, where Africa Rising now has been working since 2012, And we have chosen four different sites that represent different agroecologies, from the hot, dry Gallimotti near the lakeshore to the most high-potential mesic area closer to markets in Longway, Mintipi. So we have 1,400 farmers now engaged in mother-baby trials. And in fact, farmers are experimenting with these different options. We provide a lot of technical support and seeds initially for access to the latest varieties and integrated approaches, including integration to livestock value chains, dairy. But other farmers, you know, it depends on the different types of households and their socioeconomic, what the aspects of these legume options they might adopt. But we are trying to explore them both through this on-farm experimentation, through mother-baby trials, but also through modeling to see where things might be best disseminated. So this is intensive action research with this 1,000-some farmers and many partners, including Bunda College, Luana, and also IATA and CF. But and Extension is very integral to this work. Malawi Extension couldn't do that without them. But what we're learning, we aren't just trying to do direct development, we're trying to do research to understand where and how these technologies might have the best impact. So this is just shows you a few pictures of this on-farm experimentation with pigeon pea. Here's pigeon pea and groundnuts again, that look like doing different pigeon pea varieties. And to point out that, again, we're not just deploying certain technologies, we are trying to support farmer experimentation. And this, you can see, just after 2 years, farmers have started to expand areas, and we have female and male farmers here. Women in particular seem to be looking at the legume technologies. Here's some of the double-up legumes being tried out, and then maize and legumes, and then many are trying the small amounts of manure, compost, different integrated approaches, which don't have time to go into. But it's very interesting to start learn from which technologies farmers continue to experiment with, and then we're trying to see what are the impacts then on long-term and soils, and then ultimately on income, and even gender equity is being looked at. So what, you know, one of the big unknowns, in my view, is we promote these technologies to improve soils, but we don't know how they perform often, in particularly on in the stressed environment. And once soils are degraded, can we use a technology that really provides food every year to also improve soil fertility? So we're quantifying the biomass by these multi-purpose legumes, and I'm going to give some data, and particularly in terms of pigeon pea. And this is based on Chwimbu Gwambira's work. She's from Zimbabwe and is doing a PhD with us in Africa Rising, working with Malawi farmers closely, and has gone to almost 100 fields where she's dug pits to try and sieve out the roots so we can look at below ground what's going on. Something actually I dreamed about doing in the 90s, so it's really great to be getting back to it and seeing the next generation take this on and try and test, because we can't even calibrate models unless we really understand the interaction with farmer practices, which currently are still rigid in Malawi, although they're trying some places some other options. And you know, these degraded soils we talked about, and different weather conditions and different market conditions. These are complex environments, but one aspect is to understand performance. So let me talk about a trade-off here. It's one last issue here. In terms of, I just want to point out that on one hand, a soil pigeon pea, which some farmers tried, even though we think of this as a very good intercrop because it grows slowly at first, I think farmers wanted to particularly, this is new to many farmers in this part of Malawi, although other areas it's widely grown and sold all the way into India, as many of you know, where it's a major pull. I mean, anyone who eats Indian food is eating pigeon pea, and it's just eaten to some degree in Malawi as a green pod, for example. So pigeon pea is incredibly productive. There's roots about 10% of the biomass. You can see, you know, 12 tons on the farm, which is a phenomenal amount of biomass. And then when you combine it with groundnuts, the groundnut suppresses pigeon pea a little bit, and soya, and particularly the current system where farmers often grow pigeon pea in the south, we use maize pigeon pea. you get the least amount of pigeon pea biomass. Now, there's still a significant amount. 4 tons is enough to, you know, really support soil rehabilitation. And what about grain? You know, pigeon pea grain, again, you get the most over 2 years from a sole pigeon pea. But you get substantial amounts when you grow it with a legume, and then the least amount with maize is quite competitive with pigeon pea. But you might think, why don't farmers adopt sole pigeon pea? Well, if you look at it over 2 years and look at a maize pigeon pea intercrop each year, you start to see the reverse relationship. And then, obviously, when maize is there, or when maize is grown in a rotation, then you get quite substantial amounts of maize grain and small amounts of pigeon pea. So it's a whole different scale when we start to talk about maize. Maize is very productive. That's why people grow it. And also, maize is life in Malawi, right? It's a, you know, very important cereal around the world, in fact. But if you look at it in terms of protein, you would see that pigeon pea does a little bit better. But generally, you can see why the focus on more maize-based systems, even though it's not ideal for soil regeneration. So we're just trying to explore these trade-offs so that people understand them better. And I want to point out, this is one of the last things I hope a take-home for you, is that currently a lot of the focus is on soil maize, or even a rotation of maize, such as maize groundnut. And in some work that was done some while ago, countrywide in Malawi, we found that by just adding fertilizer, you can improve yield variability. In other words, make it more stable crops, so less variability. This is a coefficient of variation here. And so typically on farm, we get about 20% variation, but you can reduce that by adding fertilizer. You get a more vigorous crop. But the only way we can really reduce it and get a very stable, in other words, resilient crop, which is what this talk is partly about, is if we had a pigeon pea in the system. And in fact, we also, Mayors Makuna did this as well. But it was popular with farmers because Makuna is eaten only in a few areas and more for traditional and ceremonial use, and has to be heavily processed, sometimes multiple hours of fuel would require to leach out the poisons in it. So Makuna certainly is very effective also, but pigeon pea is something you can eat and sell. You know, it's much more easily in terms of fitting into the current farming system. So pigeon pea with maize, you can use half the fertilizer rate and really reduce stability. Although we weren't able to measure soil changes over the short time frame in this tremendously large major effort of the maize team back in the day at Chitedzi, however, you'll notice that you weren't able to see differences in organic matter, which takes 5 to 10 years. But the fact that maize, when it's grown after a pigeon pea doubled up system or after Makuna, in fact, it is more stable of a yield. That in itself tells you that probably that is a system that's improving the soil performance. So that's the indicator that we're using this. So we need to keep exploring different legumes, such as lab, climbing bean in colder areas, pigeon pea in different combinations, and getting new varieties of pigeon pea, such as this one that I showed you that had that tremendous amount of fuel with. Unfortunately, a lot of the improved varieties of pigeon pea keep being shorter. They call them extra, extra short duration. There are some medium duration ones that have been released in Malawi. I was talking about more throughout India and Africa. The focus, a lot of breeding efforts has been on super short types of pigeon pea. And yet what we need is these medium and long duration types, in my view, to provide some food, but also give us this real rehabilitation. And I want to take you through it from some of our crop simulation models. We can start to look at effects in different weather conditions for different soils. We have some papers on the climate change impacts and resilience to that. But here I want to focus on soils, since that's what our talk is today. So if you have a high fertility soil on the left, we compare it to a low fertility soil, the typical most of Malawi. The high fertility soil, one of the things we have to keep in mind is that then maize, in a maize pigeon pea intercrop, we're just looking at maize because farmers usually do that initially, and we don't want to put farmers' maize at risk in any way. So we have to make sure that this doesn't happen here on the bottom left, where an intercrop in the first 2 years has put maize yields at risk a little bit. We want to make sure that we are promoting systems, and this is partly because of the competition of a high maize crop in this high fertility condition. Every other year, slowly the soils built, and so maize yields responded, right? And in this is the low fertility condition, more typical of most farmers, maize by itself, with just about 20 kgs of nitrogen, just is very modest over time, and you have to do some rehabilitation in order to make a difference here in terms of through pigeon pea, you know, kind of improving. And you can see that the intercrop is exciting in that you always have a maize crop every year. The rotation is every other year, but benefits are more substantial in terms of rehabilitating the soil. And we continue to explore this because we think that there's some circumstances where maybe there's too much water use, where again we have to look at mulching and ways to improve water infiltration. So there's trade-offs here we have to think about. We're not deploying these everywhere, but we're just seeing that in fact some of these systems can cause minimum risk to the farmer, but really do some soil rehabilitation while providing doubled up legume crop, something they can eat today. So we're working on a schematic with help from the Ethical Ag and Communication team from IATA, and trying to show how there might be different sustainable intensification pathways for different farmer groups. One of them, where farmers really need to rehabilitate part of their farm. Suppose they have a hectare, so a third of it can go into this groundnut pigeon pea, and then that's moved around and you'd followed by maize bean intercrop to make sure you're addressing human nutrition needs and improve value crops to sell. So the final slide. What I want to focus here is that there may be different pathways for different groups. The entrepreneurial farmer, this lady here, you know, they linked into markets. She might be able to start to invest in latest soybean and pigeon pea varieties, inoculum for the soybean, advanced post-harvest processing, and a fairly straightforward, intensified, but sustainable production system. This is a pathway that has occurred elsewhere. Soybean has been pretty rapidly adopted in some places. But what about farmers that maybe a widow, a you know, little labor on farm? How can they rehabilitate the soil? Because they start in a degraded site. It's very hard to get out of that cycle of poverty, as we've talked about. And so we're saying through education, because we personally, I think that one of the reasons that green manures and some of these perennial pulse options have not taken off as fast as we like, because we've been working on them, we have to acknowledge, for 20 years or so, is because, in fact, they need some education. You need to have the access to the seed, but you also need to have some more information. Currently, there's no recommendations about ratoon and pigeon pea, for example. So we can start working on that with our extension colleagues and eventually help all farmers get into more sustainable intensification. Thanks very much. And in addition to all the co-authors from IATA and MSU on this talk, I also want to acknowledge, you know, the long-term relationships and support we've had from many donors and amazing farmers, as well as academic colleagues from around the world. Thanks very much. I think I wanted to just end with this top takeaways, both from Jeff and I, that we want to increase food security. I think we all are in agreement here that there needs to be ways to regenerate productive capacity of soil. But these won't get adjusted unless they fit very closely with farmer needs. I mean, Jeff and I are completely in sync with this. That's the general feeling now. But one of the ways, I feel, is through crop diversification with multi-purpose pulses. Whether you're supporting a more organic or conservation agriculture approach or sustainable intensification, integrated nutrient management, whichever approach, we do all agree that we need more living soil cover. And one of the practical ways is a first step, whatever future steps you might want to do, like Phidobia albida, which takes decades, but eventually would be just really, as long as it's called winter thorn. Some of these evergreen agriculture approaches are very important, but I think the first steps involve multi-purpose pulses such as pigeon pea and common bean. But that's my experience, and I look forward to the discussion.